Okay, so we are continuing the series about hearing the voice of God, and I wanted to talk this morning about I've titled it "Hearing the Voice of God in the Mundane and the Mystical," which sounds very lofty, but I just I wanted something punchy that you could probably try and remember. It's somewhat easy for us to imagine that God speaks in these big cosmic ideas every time. We hear kind of the direct voice of God in the Bible. It's really to do with these massive, cosmic, world-affecting ideas. Moses saying, "Show me your glory," and we hear God say, "Yahweh, Yahweh," it's God declaring who He is, and it's this massive verse. That section of the Bible is the most quoted part of the Bible by the Bible. That's God's declaration of who He is. It becomes this key moment in the history of God, and we hear things like, "This is my son, my beloved son, with whom I'm well pleased." This, voice of God moment. It's this world-affecting launch of Jesus into His ministry, and so it's kind of easy for us to find examples of God speaking and it being this big, massive, world-affecting moment. And it can be more difficult for us to then think that God would want to speak about anything to do with the small little moments in our lives, what I might be wearing in the morning, what I might have for breakfast, those tiny little ideas. God actually cares about the detail of our lives all the way down to those little tiny moments. I want to tell the story of the first time I remember hearing God. All right. I was going to say I'm the goofy looking one, but that doesn't really help for that one. But I'm dead center there. So this is me. I couldn't find an exact of that moment, but this is the holiday we were on. We went to the US and we were driving around Monterey Bay, California, and we could not find somewhere to stay. I don't know what my parents did or didn't do to not have somewhere to stay with three kids, but I'm not judging. Anyway, we just could not find somewhere to stay in this town. And I remember Dad pulling to the side of the road and just saying, "Okay, we're just going to pray." And we all kind of sat in silence for a minute and prayed. And then Dad turns around and says, "All right, did anyone hear anything?" And I think someone said, "I heard turn right." And I said, "Oh, I heard three pines or three times." And so we went, "Okay, let's go ahead and we'll drive out and we'll turn right three times." That's how we took what God was saying, and we thought, so anyway, we take off and we took the next three right turns. And as we took the last right turn, we were pulling into the car park of the Hilton Monterey Bay. It was, and I have to say, we did not stay at the Hilton Monterey Bay that night, which, we didn't listen to the word of God, I guess, but we stayed in probably the worst hotel of the trip. It was a bit of a nightmare where we ended up staying. So, maybe there was an invitation to abundance there, but it was impacting to me the fact that, God cared about a simple thing like, where were we staying that night? It wasn't this big world-affecting change. It was a small local problem, which was just like, where are we going to lay our heads to rest tonight? That changed my mind about the way that God spoke. That moment, that God can speak into the small, into the little moments in our lives, and He can speak into the big. I don't want to like swing all the way one way, but God is speaking about all of these things, a whole spectrum of big cosmic ideas all the way down to small local ideas. It's kind of like, I love that analogy that Brad shared from Bill Johnson last week. If you think about a radio, there's music all around us, there's TV all around us. If we just had the right equipment to tune into what's going on around us, we can hear it. And if you think about a radio, there's a whole range of frequency, there's a whole band of frequency. And I imagine that, there's a frequency all the way up the end that's like, here's God speaking these massive ideas, and then all the way down the bottom, he's speaking these small little ideas. It's that small quiet whisper. In fact, this week, we were walking to a cafe, And my wife is on maternity leave. Well, the maternity leave ran out, so money's a little bit, you know, more of a thing we've been thinking about lately. It's a little tighter than usual. So we're walking to the cafe, to a cafe, and Sarah said, I'm just not sure if I'm going to get a coffee today. Just not sure if it's worth the $5 or whatever it costs these days. Anyway, we get there, and she says, you know, I think I will have a coffee. And I go ahead, order our coffees, and the lady behind the counter says, actually, one's been paid for. It's, someone paid it forward just before they came through. And, you know, you could take that moment and think, oh, that's a really nice coincidence. Or you could take that as God actually reassuring us in that moment that, hey, I'm here, I'm providing for you. I'm aware of your needs, even if it is, you know, an almond flat white. Those are things that are important to God. And for us, that was really, we perceived that event as like God was speaking to us. But I think you have to be ready to notice God in the small moments. Yeah, I just find, like in my life, there are so many coincidences that I could just write off as, that's just a thing that happened. Or I could actually take it as, this is communication from God. I want to talk this morning about Joseph. Joseph in Genesis, not Joseph in the New Testament. And in preparing for this, I was thinking through kind of how we approach the Old Testament. I think it can be a bit of a tricky prospect to approach the Old Testament because, yeah, how we might read the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. So I was thinking about, like, these are probably the most common ways of approaching the Old Testament. The first is that it's historical narrative, which, you know, obviously there's parts of the Old Testament that aren't even narrative at all. They're poetry or other things. But for the most part, a large portion of it, you know, you could take as historical narrative. You could read it as like an allegory for modern readers, like that, you know, maybe these things aren't literally all true things that happened, but, you know, they're a metaphor for our lives that, like, you know, Israel crossing over into the promised land is about, like, us claiming victory or conquering or overcoming obstacles, or you could take, you know, an allegorical reading. Or you could read them, this is kind of the Sunday school approach, I think, is that you could take them as kind of moral stories, as like, here's a thing that happens, and then right at the end you get a kind of like, and God is with us because, you know, this and this happens. And none of these are particularly wrong. I don't want to, like, say this is the right one, this is the wrong one. I think for, you know, historical narrative, the pro, I guess, is like that we have a trust for the historicity and truth claims of the Old Testament, that there's, you know, there's something about the actual historical story that is important, but that we might miss the metaphorical or prophetic even significance of what that story is pointing towards. If we think about allegory, we could interpret the Old Testament in a way that feels relevant and applicable, which is good. That's a positive thing. But it might make it easier for us to kind of create distance between the Old Testament and the New Testament to say, like, you know, that's a bunch of stories, and then here is, you know, here's the one that's important for us. You know, and probably plays into a tendency we have where we want to say, you know, where we might draw a line and say, you know, Old Testament God was different, and then New Testament God decided to be nice and then showed up in the person of Jesus. But actually, you know, God's consistent throughout that story. And so instead of trying to solve for that by putting the Old Testament in a box and then putting it in the cupboard, we have to actually kind of wrestle with that and reconcile that. And then as far as moral stories, like we can glean instruction on how to live well, which is a good thing. And, you know, Paul writes that that all scripture is good for learning and instruction. But we can kind of have this Sunday school black and white view of all the characters in the stories. Of like, you know, there's good guys, there's bad guys, and there's good outcomes, there's bad outcomes. And we can miss some of the nuance of what's going on in the story. And it, frankly, like, in the Old Testament, some of the stories are just immoral, confusing, violent, uncomfortable. Like, that exists in the Bible. I don't know if you've read it recently, but it's hard to reconcile. It's easy to come across something, especially in the Old Testament, that makes you go, what? Like, I'm not sure how to, like, make sense of that in and it can really shake you. You have to bear with me today because I'm maybe going a little bit abstract. But what I want to do today is kind of try and have a high level at least, take a couple of different readings of the Genesis narrative. We're going to read kind of I'm just going to summarize what happens because it's pretty long. I want to think about, you know, what's the narrative that's going on? What's the kind of, what I would say is like, this is the mundane of like, in terms of like, what's happening in Joseph's actual life? What do we learn about how God speaks from Joseph's experiences? And then to me, there's this prophetic significance of the Joseph story, which is like, what do we learn about how God speaks from how the story points to the person of Jesus? So there's something about Joseph that if you're a Bible nerd, you might call Joseph a type of Christ, not like he is a Messiah, but he's like he's prototypical of the Messiah. There's lots of other characters in the Old Testament that you would also make that connection with that are prototypical of Christ, like characters like Melchizedek and even Moses to some extent, King David, those sorts of characters that are kind of pointing towards an eventual future. And Joseph's one of these, all the way back in Genesis, mind you, like we're really early on in the Bible here. So, and that to me is like kind of that like high level cosmic mystical idea. Does that make sense? I know we're going a little bit abstract and strange, but this is kind of how I want to approach the story of Joseph. All right, so we're going to read through Genesis 37 and Genesis 40. So probably if you've got Bibles with you, I'm going to read through. I'm not going to read through. I'm probably going to summarize just to kind of push us forward. But if you've got it with you, it might be helpful to just kind of like scan along. And again, just as a reminder, it's easy to think of these, like see these stories and think of good guys and bad guys and think, you know, Joseph's the good guy. And then, but it's a mess. Like, as we know with some of these, like it's like there's lots of nuance. There's lots of messy gray characters. So, start of 37, we're introduced to Joseph, who's Jacob's favourite son. He's 17 at the time. His brothers hate him because he's the favourite and they know it, which would be a bit rough. And Jacob even goes as far as to give Joseph a many-coloured coat. Someone should write a musical about that. And so Joseph has a dream and he recounts it to his brothers, which is, he dreamed that they were binding sheaves in the field, and then his stood upright, and then all of the others bowed down to him. So it's kind of, you know, it's a pretty explicit what he's trying to imply with that dream. It's not mentioned as like particularly a prophetic dream. It's not even mentioned as a God gave me this dream. You got to remember here as well, we're very early on in the Genesis story, so the idea of like that idea that Moses, show me your glory, where God says who he is, that hasn't even happened yet. So, you know, they have this very vague and abstract idea of who God is. They don't have a personal understanding of who God is. God has, like, they don't even know God as Yahweh at this point. But there's an implication, I think it's implied that it's a prophetic dream, because his brothers basically take it as, you're telling us this dream because you think it's, you know, it's a foretelling of what's going to happen, right? So, at the ground level, at the story level, we can see that, you know, God speaks in dreams. We're setting up early on that God can speak to us through the idea of dreams. And I think the other thing is that, you know, maybe we need to be careful about who we're sharing what God's speaking to us with. We need to be careful about that. Sometimes God's speaking things to us that are just for us. Now, I don't know if it's necessary for Joseph to share this with his brothers in order to eventually fulfill them, because they, you know, the rest of the story happens, but this kind of instigates that. But, you know, I think God would have been able to make this happen regardless. So I don't know whether it was wise or not for Joseph to have shared it. But I think there is wisdom in us as we get a word from God to consider whether it's something that is to be shared or something to be kept to ourselves. He has a second dream, and the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bow down to him. And at that point, his father rebukes him, saying, are you saying, you know, we're going to bow down to you? Your mum and your dad are going to bow down to you and your brothers? So Jacob sends Joseph to his brothers to come check on them. And the brothers plot to kill him. They say, well, we'll murder him and then he'll be dealt with. Reuben, who is the oldest son, convinces them not to harm him, but they're going to put him into a hole. And Reuben says, I'll come back. Like, basically, he says, I'll get them to put him in a hole and then I'll come back and I'll pluck him out and I'll take him back. So he's planning to save him. So the brothers take Joseph, they strip him of his coat, and then they throw him into a pit. And then Reuben goes away, and Judah says, hold on, if we're not going to kill him, we're going to leave him in a pit. We may as well make some money off this. So they sell him to some Ishmaelites as they're heading through to Egypt, and he's sold for 20 shekels of silver. And then they kill a goat, and they dip the robe into the goat's blood, and they take it back to Jacob, and Jacob, tears his clothes and mourns, basically, for the loss of Joseph. And then Joseph is sold to Potiphar, who is kind of the captain of the guard in Egypt, an officer of Pharaoh. All right, so I think on the next slide I've got some of the stuff that I mentioned as we were going through it. So, yeah, just at that kind of mundane story level, we see that God speaks through dreams. I think there's this implication that sometimes when God speaks, it's just for us. And then the other thing is just like sometimes God's word feels far from our experiences, is that Joseph gets these dreams of him ruling, basically, and him being the greatest among his brothers, and then only a few lines later, he's in a hole and he's getting sold away. And so it feels like in this part of the story that we're moving further away from what God has said about Joseph. I want to throw it over to you all to turn in to people next to you. And just to say, just on the next slide, I think there's a question. Yeah, in what ways does Genesis 37 reflect the story of Jesus? I know we didn't read it super directly, but I tried to make some call-outs to prompt you to think about what's reminding you of Jesus here. But does anyone want to call out some things they discussed? What reminds them? Yeah. Yeah, they tried to kill Joseph and people plotted to kill Jesus as well. Yep, definitely. Yep, Jesus and Joseph were both persecuted. Yep. Yeah, people didn't take what he said seriously. And people hated him for the words that he spoke, not just for who he was. Yep. Yeah, they were jealous. Yep. Sold for silver. Yeah, that's a really great parallel. Sold for silver. In both, God has a plan. Just written a few down that are pretty direct. He's stripped of his coat, so that's a pretty direct reference to Jesus was stripped of his coat. Sold for silver was an awesome one. I think, it's like, it blows my mind when I read this stuff sometimes. It's like, how does this line up so perfectly? Joseph, I think, probably has some of the most parallels of any of the kind of types of Christ. He's sold on the suggestion of Judah, which is kind of the same name where we get the name Judas. It's kind of, a bit of a, that might be a bit tenuous. And then Reuben returns to an empty pit. I actually didn't mention that part of the story, but they throw him into the pit and he's sold, and then Reuben comes back and his plan is to come and save Joseph, and then he realizes that he's gone and he despairs. So, but to me, it recalls the coming back to an empty tomb with Jesus. So I love, as we read this story, we can see God's ability to speak directly in, you know, there's something happening in the story to Joseph, and we can read it as like, here's God's, the way that God speaks directly to people about their lives, and he's also speaking on a larger scale, on a grander narrative about things that are going on, and the story that's being told over the course of the entire Bible. All right, I want to pick up in Genesis 40. So Genesis 38 is weird. You can go and read it later if you want, but it's just, you know, typical Genesis weirdness. Judah is up to some shenanigans, so you get a lot about the line of Judah and some odd things. So, you know, that one's a bit PG, I guess, so read at your own risk. And then in 39, we pick up with Joseph. He's serving Potiphar in his house, and Potiphar's wife basically tries to seduce him multiple times until finally she manages to get one piece of his clothing as he runs out, and then uses that to kind of accuse him and say, well, you know, he tried to seduce me. And so Joseph is thrown into prison, and then that's where we pick up in Genesis 40. So after Joseph is thrown into prison, and Joseph in prison basically becomes like the chief of the prisoners pretty quickly. Like he is raised to status very quickly. The warden, he finds favor with the warden because it just seems to be the kind of guy that he is, that he steps into a scenario and he is all of a sudden the leader. So sometime after he's thrown into prison, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker committed some sort of offense against the king of Egypt and they're put in prison. And the keeper of the prison appoints Joseph to attend to them because he's got favor. And then one night they both dreamed dreams and they're troubled because they don't know how to interpret them. And so Joseph told them that God was the interpreter of dreams, that he asked them to recount their dreams to him. And the cupbearer dreams about a vine with three branches and the vine blooms and grapes grew on it. And then he squeezes the grapes into Pharaoh's cup, basically. And then Joseph interprets the dream and says in 3 days that he would be released from prison and be reinstated to his role. And then Joseph says to the cupbearer, mention me to Pharaoh so that you could get me out of prison. Like, remember me when you get back to Pharaoh. And then the baker heard the interpretation and said, okay, interpret my dream. And he dreamed of three cake baskets on his head. And in the top basket, there were baked goods prepared for Pharaoh, but birds came and started eating the food. And then Joseph told him the three baskets represented 3 days. And in 3 days, Pharaoh would hang the baker on a tree and the birds would come out and eat his flesh, which is a bit of a rough interpretation. So 3 days later, Pharaoh celebrated his birthday with a feast. He brings up the cupbearer and he brings up the baker from the prison. And what Joseph said came to pass. The cupbearer gets his job back. The baker is hanged. And the chief cupbearer forgets to mention Joseph to the Pharaoh. And so he's still in prison. To me, the biggest thing here is that Joseph has to, like, Joseph interprets the dreams of others before even seeing his own words and his own dreams fulfilled. I think that's kind of the biggest lesson here for us is sometimes we have to have patience with the words that we have, and the trickiest thing can be is to hear God for other people in the midst of our own wrestles, in the midst of our own waiting. And that's kind of the situation that Joseph's in, is that he's probably at the low point of the story, which is like, not only is he thrown into a pit and his family hates him and they've cast him out and they've sold him into slavery, now he can't even be a good slave. He's all the way in prison. It's like the low point of the Joseph story. Yet still in here, we see, you know, he's faithful to God. He says, you know, God's the interpreter of dreams. But he's able to actually be a blessing to those around him. Well, a blessing to one of the people around him. and at least by interpreting their dreams. So, yeah, that's kind of, and we see that God continues to speak in dreams. That and God, like, I think the other thing we see here is that God can speak to people even when they're not attuned to hear it. You know, that the God is clearly speaking to the baker and the cupbearer, but they don't have the skills, they don't have the tool set to actually perceive it that way. And that can be a way in which we're a blessing to other people, is to actually open their eyes to the ways that God is speaking in their lives. So in terms of the story of Jesus, so we get the cupbearer and the baker, which is, you know, we get the wine and the bread, which is, to me, reminds me of, you know, Jesus is the two elements of the sacrament. We get two prisoners, which, like, and remember, we're at the low point of Joseph's journey here. He's about to be raised up, basically. And so at the low point of the Jesus story, we get him with two criminals either side of him. In Jesus' story, he pronounces judgment on one and he pronounces redemption for another, which is exactly what happens in Joseph's story as well. We get 3 days over and over, 3 days later, 3 days later. All of these things are going to happen 3 days later, which, you know, if we're taking this as kind of Joseph's crucifixion moment, essentially, because it's the low point before he's about to be raised up. Yeah, we just get that 3 days, 3 days over and over again. And then Joseph asks a prisoner to remember him, which to me recalls the criminal asking Jesus to remember him. So we get a kind of reverse of that in the Jesus narrative. We get the criminal saying, "Remember me in paradise," or "Remember me when you move on." But in this story, we get Joseph saying, "Remember me." So again, like we just see, to me, it's God setting up for this grander narrative that's going on. So hopefully that wasn't too abstract and strange for you. It's a helpful skill to be able to come to the Bible and think, you know, there are multiple readings going on here. There's multiple things going on here. I think there's so much value in the surface level and the actual narrative of what's going on. But there's also value in, like, let's take a bigger picture and have a think about what God is speaking over the long term. But I think as we apply that to our lives, we can almost have the reverse problem where we can think about the large scale things that God might be speaking to us about. And so we can miss the small little details that God's not only interested in, but he's involved in and he's speaking into constantly. The little small decisions and details in our lives that really comprise of life is the small little minutia. I love this quote from George MacDonald just on the next. So he said, "With his divine alchemy turns not only water into wine, but common things into radiant mysteries, yea, every meal into a Eucharist, and the jaws of death into an outgoing gate." I just love that perspective on life that, you know, if we have eyes to see it, everything can be transformed into this divine encounter. Even getting a coffee at the cafe can become this encounter with God. Not with, you know, this hugely powerful, shaken to the floor kind of moment, but just in a gentle kind of hand on the shoulder kind of moment that allows us to realize that God is with us, that allows us to realize that we're provided for. So I just want to encourage you with that. And I want to pray for you that this week for you would be a blessing of small things, that you would have small encounters, many small encounters with the voice of God, and that you would be able to find him in the small details of your life. So let's pray. Father, we thank you that you are not only concerned with the large world-affecting ideas, but you care deeply about our lives, about the small decisions that we make, and about who we're becoming in that. And I just ask, Father, that you would continue to speak in those ways and that we would have the ears to hear, the eyes to see, and perceive the small things that you're saying, the ways in which you are constantly showing us that you are with us. So we just we choose to just tune ourselves into the frequency of you saying those small things, and we choose to see you. We choose to see you in absolutely every detail of our lives, and that we would be witness to that to those around us as well. We ask this in your name. Thank you. I'll hand back to Brad.
Thanks, John. Yeah. So may we, just appreciate how God is just brilliant. He just weaves so much into life. And to quote the great philosopher Shrek, you know, there's layers to so much of what God does and says. And may we be attentive to the things that are happening around us and the coincidences that happen. I love the quote I think I mentioned from Einstein. Coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous, his hand at work in our lives. So just, maybe we be generous in sharing the things that we're hearing from God or as people share with us, just helping them to see the reality of God in their situation or their circumstances. So pray that you'll be generous with the opportunities that God gives you this week to do that and to show his kindness to people. And may we do that this morning over morning tea. So thank you for being here this morning. Thanks for coming. Come again. And if anyone needs prayer, certainly just come forward. There'll be people here that'll be available to pray into any situation that you've got. But otherwise, God bless you richly. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being part of the family.